Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 23rd, 2004. Today's session number is MOP 2004-05. Today's speaker is Philip Moat. And the lesson for today is Global Environmental Challenges Solutions. Solutions to these global environmental challenges. Let's listen in.
Get started. My name is Philip Moat, and if you've been coming to any of these sessions this week on global environmental challenges, you've heard some kind of depressing stories the last couple days about species loss and global warming, and some encouraging stories on Tuesday about acid rain and ozone depletion problems that the international policy and scientific community have at least started solving. Today we get to have a very different kind of discussion, and I don't have a whole lot of slides, so I want to move through them fairly quickly and then leave time for discussion. So, this was the outline of the whole week. I guess I've kind of gone over that already. So, just a review of the climate issue. In the last 100 years, this is what the global average temperature has done, roughly, an increase of, well, this is 1990, so this is 2000, so an increase of roughly 1 degree Fahrenheit. And then the gray area shows the whole range of projections over the next 100 years. And to some extent, that depends on the choices that the human race makes now. Are we going to continue burning fossil fuels with abandon, or are we going to start rethinking that? And the diagram on the right with all the red indicates that for a number of important factors, like how widely distributed negative impacts are, or the risk from extreme climate events, basically the more climate change we impose on the world, the more negative consequences we're likely to experience. And so this is sort of a clarion call to say let's start thinking about stopping this thing. In fact, as I related on Wednesday, in 1992, there was an international policy document, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which the U.S. signed, which had at its goal the stabilization of greenhouse gases at a level that would prevent dangerous interference with the climate system. Now, that's a very subjective term, dangerous interference, and at what level do you assign danger? Is it danger when permafrost is melting and roads in Alaska are crumbling? Is it danger when low-lying islands are starting to be submerged? Does it have to be at least 1% of the land area that's negatively affected? So this is a discussion that really was postponed. And now scientists are finally starting to engage policymakers in that discussion. What is dangerous interference? But this diagram is meant to be sort of a guide to that discussion. A key part of solving the climate issue is the use and the production of energy. Because energy generation, by and large, produces carbon dioxide, which is the leading greenhouse gas. And methane, also one of which is natural gas, is tied up in that. This shows both a history and a future projection of different fuels and also the total world energy demand, which is the top curve. And you can see that there's been an enormous growth in energy demand starting really around 1950, up to the present. It's more than tripled, and it's expected that it will probably triple again within the next 50 years. So this is we're talking about finding vast amounts of energy. Now, traditional biomass, this red curve, that's all that was available before we started burning coal. That just means, basically chopping down trees. And coal is the gray curve, and under this scenario, coal use would peak around 2040 and then start declining. This was put together by Shell International. That may be optimistic. There's no reason to think that coal would run out in the next 200 years. So turning away from coal in 50 years would be merely a deliberate choice in a world that's very concerned about climate change. Oil is in green, and in this scenario, world oil use peaks around 2020 and starts declining. And in a moment, I'll show projections of when world oil production will naturally peak even without considering greenhouse gas reductions. And then natural gas is this tan curve, which sort of rides on top and of the others and peaks also in about 2020, but does not decline. Natural gas is much better than coal. You get a lot more energy per carbon dioxide molecule produced. In the current mix of energy, we also have a small percentage of hydro and nuclear, and just beginning to be a bit of wind. The total mix of world energy today is 85% fossil fuels, 15% renewables, of which, as you can see, hydro and nuclear are the main share. So if we think about how we could meet future demand of energy without increasing greenhouse gas emissions, or in fact adhering to the principle laid out in the Framework Convention in 1992 of stabilizing greenhouse gases. Now, stabilization can only be done not with the 5 to 8% cuts being talked about with the Kyoto Protocol, which, as we discussed the other day, is not even likely to succeed. We're talking more about 80% cuts. So this scenario where in say 2060, two-thirds of the energy is from renewable sources, hydro, nuclear, wind, biomass, solar, geothermal, and what they call surprise. Something that hasn't been invented yet, but is providing more than 10% of our power by 2060. This is just one scenario, but it's not going to happen if market forces are left alone to create it. These early peaks in coal and oil would only happen with a deliberate policy effort. So let's go to the next slide. This is an analysis of when global oil production could peak or would likely peak. The red shaded area shows the 5 to 95% probability that the world oil will peak given a 2% annual increase in oil demand, which is roughly what we've been experiencing. The orange shaded area, sort of 2030 to 2060, shows when it would peak given a 1% increase in demand, and then the yellow shaded area, 2045 to 2100, shows the range of estimates of when it would peak given zero growth in demand for oil. So oil is just one share of that overall energy pie. It will naturally peak sometime during this century, very, very likely. For some time now, world oil production has exceeded new discoveries of oil. So we're clearly in the process of running out of oil. It's just a question of when that peak will occur, the peak production. Once the peak production occurs, prices will naturally rise substantially, and these recent price increases that we've seen will look back fondly on the days of $2 a gallon gasoline. So this is happening on its own. Then there's the species extinction, of course, too. And we talked about land use and overall consumption of wood and paper products and red meat, which a lot of which is grown in third world countries where they're cutting down forests to grow cattle. So as we think about these really big questions, the global energy supply and things like that, it can feel overwhelming. And in fact, polls show that a lot of people kind of understand that climate change is a problem and biodiversity is a problem, but they just feel powerless to do anything about it. And so I want to say, first of all, that we individually have the power to effect change. And we, as the Church of Jesus Christ, also have a power and a responsibility to effect change. Now, there are little steps that we individuals can take, and I'll come to those later. But to set the stage, let's talk about what is needed globally. First of all, we need a revolution in the way we produce energy. And that's what was illustrated in that diagram a little bit ago. To go from 85% fossil fuels to 40% fossil fuels would require huge investments in renewable energy, huge commitments on the part of utilities to support renewable energy. There's been a proposal in Congress called the Renewable Portfolio Standard, or RPS, which is basically a commitment to have at least 10 or 20% renewable energy by every utility by a certain deadline. And that failed. But different states have enacted RPSs, Renewable Portfolio Standards. Those are modest goals, 10 or 20% renewables, that every utility could achieve in 10 years, and it would not cost a huge amount. So this is one revolution that we clearly need. The second revolution is a revolution in the way we use land. And this is tied up both to the loss of biodiversity, where tropical forests especially, as we discussed yesterday, just huge treasure troves of species diversity. And they're being cut down for really fairly temporary uses. The soils in these tropical forests are not very rich, and you can farm them for a few years, and then you start having to apply so much fertilizer that it really becomes uneconomical. But it's not just that sort of, oh, well, those guys in the tropics need to fix their act. A lot of the problem with energy has to do with the way Americans choose to live, work, and drive. Most of us live somewhere between 5 and 20 miles away from work, and the easiest way to get there is to drive. And the sprawl that most cities have experienced is in large measure driving the demands for oil, for U.S. oil, but also around the world. They're developing countries as well, where the major cities are sprawling. The easiest measure of sprawl is the ratio of new land growth to new population growth. If your land area of your city is growing faster than the population, then that is sprawl. If it's growing slower than population, it's not sprawl. Boise, Idaho is a good example of sprawl, where the new developments are farther and farther out, and they're bigger and bigger. Portland is the opposite. Portland in the 1960s established an urban area and funneled all growth into that urban area to densify. And so it has experienced population growth of roughly 50% during a time when its land use grew only about 10%. Cleveland, Ohio, had exactly the opposite. The land area increased by a third, the population decreased by a third. So people are sort of emptying out and sprawling out. And this just feeds, you know, destruction of natural habitat. It feeds use of fossil fuels. So we really need to rethink urban design. I had a fascinating conversation at breakfast today with a fellow from Seattle who's an architect. And I really wish he could have been here today, but they were leaving to go back to Seattle. He's been working on the principles of sustainable design in buildings. And two of the projects that we talked about, I want to mention to you. One is a university housing complex in Seattle, not far from where I work, where simply by treating some of the wastewater on site using natural processes, ponds and so on, they were able to virtually eliminate the need for sewage treatment. And the city gave them a $700,000 essentially gift on this project, which meant that it was actually cheaper to do it that way than to build the regular way where they're just building a huge sewer pipe that goes to the city. Even more exciting is a project he's working on in Portland. It's going to cover 30 blocks, 30 city blocks on the east side of the city. And the principle that they're operating on is that community will use no more energy than solar energy provided during the course of the year. So they will collect solar energy, they'll put it back into the grid when they have a surplus, they'll take it out when they don't. They're also not going to use any more water than falls on that community during the course of the year. So just revolutionary concepts, but this is what it means to be sustainable, to use only what nature provides in a sensible way. This is going to require huge... yeah, you can sit here and put that on your lap if you want. This is going to require huge changes in our... our goals in choosing a home, if we choose to go this route. When you're ready now, hit to the next. And also, you know, we tend to think in these sort of big energy land community planning things, but we also need a revolution in the way we view other species. The Endangered Species Act is a good way to code into law the principle that we don't want to allow identifiable species to slip into extinction without at least some effort to save them. But we also need to think about the entire ecosystem services, the microbes, the snails, the flies, all of these things as intrinsically valuable because God created them, and also as useful functioning parts of this planet that we're given that sustains life. Another piece of the energy puzzle, of course, is efficiency. Not simply producing energy differently, but also using it. And in fact, in a lot of cases, we can use energy more efficiently and actually get a net economic benefit. This is particularly true in buildings, where you've got a design lifetime, typically, of 50 years. And one of the things that I was talking about with Ron this morning was he's got economists on his team who talk about, you know, the time that it will take to pay off an investment in making the building more energy efficient. So there's a huge net positive economic incentive to design buildings to be more energy efficient. For a lot of industrial applications, these, you know, huge machines that a lot of factories use, they have naturally been going toward more energy efficiency because it makes good business sense. With home appliances, this is also generally true. And the refrigerator is an interesting story. Some time ago, I think it was about 10 years ago, the federal government had been sort of pushing refrigerator manufacturers to make a more efficient version. And so they had been, but they said, nobody's buying it. You know, the numbers are weak. Why should we keep doing this? And so somebody did a little analysis, and they realized that most of the people who buy a refrigerator are not the people who are going to be paying the electric bills on the refrigerator. It's either a developer who's, you know, putting up a whole bunch of houses and then selling them, or it's a landlord who's going to be having the tenants pay. And so they said, well, the sensible thing to do is to simply mandate the higher energy efficiency standard. It's going to add $50 to the cost of the average fridge, but the person paying the bills will see that benefit within a year. And so they enacted that standard, and sure enough, you know, the energy savings easily paid for the cost. You know, there, in some cases, obviously, the cost was being paid, the cost of the refrigerator was being paid by the developer or the landlord, but overall, the energy used by refrigerators has improved. Similar efforts were underway to do this with other appliances like air conditioners. When Bush arrived in office in 2001, and this was one of the things that his administration didn't like. But it makes economic sense, you know, looking at the economy as a whole. Well, what about transportation? There are a variety of ways that we can move around more effectively, and I'll come back to that shortly, but we can make huge improvements, actually, in personal travel energy use without reducing the number of miles, simply by buying better technology. So next. Now, I want to step back from these sort of, we need these revolutions to talk about what can we individually do. And in this context, in the context of Holden, I think it's very important to say that the first step is to connect with God and to connect with nature and to connect with each other. I'll explain what I mean by these. The second, obviously, is that we cannot cut back on fossil fuel production and so on, and land use and so on, without some eventual reduction in consumption. And so it's a call to consume less, to live more simply, and also to consume more wisely. And then thirdly, we can speak out. So let me elaborate on each of these. Clearly from the Bible, as we look at our role within a community of faith, the first step in recognizing a problem is to repent. And it's very easy when we talk about environmental problems to, well, let's just blame Bush for everything. Or let's just blame those multinational corporations. Or let's hope that somebody will come along and invent some magic technology that's going to solve everything. But we have to recognize, number one, that's not going to happen. And number two, that in a sense we're all complicitous. And if you read through the Old Testament prophecy passages, time after time, some calamity befalls Israel, and it's a call to the whole nation to repent, not simply to the leaders who can be conveniently blamed, or to the military who, you know, made some bad decisions and lost the battle. It's a call to the whole nation. So I want to start with that, that in our personal prayer lives, we can just say, Lord, I am sorry that I have chosen to live my life in a way that just consumes a lot of resources. And it's difficult to do that without feeling guilty, but that's how God calls us, I think, to begin looking at these problems. And second is to keep the Sabbath. And I think time after time today, we'll see that much about life at Holden is exactly what is needed. And Sabbath keeping is important because it's a day to step away from consuming, from shopping. It's a day to rest, to just be a child of God and not be someone who is identified as, oh, well, I serve this role in society. I produce. I'm a writer. I am a bus driver, whatever. Instead, just to say, I am a child of God and I rest and I don't consume. The third is to enjoy and value nature. Nature is such a treasure, and you know, again, being up here with the forest and the stunningly blue sky and the deer wandering around, it's easy to do that. Several years ago, we went camping not far from here with our kids, and I realized partway through a walk that I kept saying, wow, look at that mountain, look at that tree, and they kept saying, look at that flower, look at that little rock. And I think both perspectives are really valued, that, you know, nature is the big and impressive, and it's also the tiny and the functional. Fourthly, and this kind of relates to that point, we ought to teach and discuss creation care within our families and our faith communities, to look at these issues from the standpoint of stewardship and say, let's see how we as a community can be better stewards. In our church a few years ago, an environmental group formed, and one of the first things that we decided to do was to host a community transportation fair. Our church is in an urban area, and there's a lot of foot traffic past the church on Sunday mornings. So we set up tables, and we had some hybrid cars, and we had an electric bike, and information about, you know, carpooling and so on. And people would stop by, and they'd look under the hood of the Toyota Prius, and they'd be engaged. This was a way to witness not just to our own congregants, but also to the wider community, and talk about creation care as an important part of how we live. And finally, that this all works toward building a transformative community within our churches and within our neighborhoods, to where we start to think about, can I make do without a power lawnmower and maybe share with my neighbor? Can I make do without, you know, 10 different yard implements and maybe share with my neighbor? Can I figure out a way to carpool? Can I figure out a way to reduce the number of things I own and the number of things I consume? And I like the passage in Acts describing, and I meant to bring my Bible and read it, but describing the early Christian church, and how they broke bread together, they prayed together, and they shared all things together. They shared what they had. And I think that's part of how we address both social inequities and also these huge environmental problems that we're confronting. Well, if you want to know the kind of easier, simpler things, the Union of Concerned Scientists produced a book about 3 or 4 years ago called The Consumer's Guide to Effective Environmental Choices. And they did a bunch of analysis of the impacts of consumer choices on the environment. And they boiled it down to 4 basic impact areas: global climate change, which they said is the most problematic, land use change, which has to do globally with species loss, and also air and water pollution. And considering all of those things, they came up with a list, and I'm only giving you the top 2. The first is to reduce consumption of gas, not just because of the climate change, but also because of local air pollution and water pollution in the production process, and then, of course, if there's a spill, but also because of the occasional the land use issues, like with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And if you think about our life up here at Holden, when was the last time any of you rode in a motor vehicle? It was when you arrived, right? Or maybe you went down for a day trip or something. But we can go for days or weeks without ever riding on a motor vehicle. And in some of our cities, that's possible as well. You can ride the bus, and that, I guess that's one kind of a motor vehicle. That's nothing nowhere near as consumptive as a personal car. So purchases of gasoline are the single biggest way that you can affect the environment. The second is consumption of red meat, because it takes 7 times as much protein to create a pound of protein in red meat as it does if you just eat grain. So red meat is a big one. And again, here in Holden, they're very down on red meat, which I miss desperately. But I would say also, this wasn't really in the UCS study, but clearly with produce, we can choose more organic, more local, more sustainable agriculture. I didn't say number 3 on this list because it's kind of shocking. Number 3 is consumption of fruits and vegetables. And simply because it requires so much land and pesticides and so on. So, and because so much fruits and vegetables is transported long distances. So rather than just say, don't eat fruits and vegetables, which is kind of what you get out of the UCS book, I said, choose organic, local, and sustainable, which, again, Holden is doing in spades. All right, so here's some examples of consumer choices that are huge. The Toyota Prius, it won the 2004 Motor Trend Car of the Year award. It's a hybrid gas-electric vehicle, which means it has both a gas engine and an electric motor with batteries that don't need to be recharged. And it's very energy efficient. It runs the gas motor when it needs to, and it runs off the electric motor when it can. And the energy just sort of goes back and forth between the batteries, and it has regenerative braking, so that when you want to slow down, instead of just heating up the brake drums, you're actually recharging the battery. This allows it to get 60 miles per gallon in the city, 52 on the highway, and it seats 5, and it's a pretty good sized car. The other neat thing about the Prius and the other hybrids is that they have much higher tech engines that allow them to operate much more narrowly within the range of parameters to get the best fuel combustion, so that they're producing fewer pollutants in the combustion process. They're able to tune the engines that way. Well, this is one consumer choice. Another option that Americans have and are choosing in great numbers is, of course, the Hummer. Now, this thing is so huge that it actually is not required to be tested by the EPA for gas mileage. But estimates are that it gets about 10 miles per gallon, which is 1/6 what the Prius gets. And it seats 6, so I suppose if you have a family of 6, you really need that extra seat. It's
an important option.
Now, yeah. Question?
I was just going to add, if you're not going to say it, the plus for the Hummer is it cuts the distance to the next gas, time to the next gas station.
That's true. You get to feel much more option.
Yes?
Does the Toyota also recharge better with its gas engine?
It does, yeah. It recharges, you don't need to plug it in. So it just recharges the battery either with the gas engine or with the regenerative braking.
Plug in tooth, I believe?
It doesn't plug in at all. And it's got a little display, a neat display that shows where the energy is flowing. So it'll show, you know, energy is flowing from the battery to the wheels, or from the wheels to the battery, or from the gas motor to the wheels, or from the gas motor to the battery.
Or the wheels to the battery.
I've heard from several accounts that the Prius does not actually get those official ratings.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, the test course that the EPA uses is a little different from the mix that people have. My dad has a Prius. The older generation of Prius, and it's rated at 52 city, 45 highway, and I think he averages about 48, which is almost all city driving. The reason is that until the gas motor is warm, which typically takes it 2 to 4 miles, it won't even run the electric motor. So if, as in the case of my father, the commute is only 4 miles, you're driving it almost all on gas. Whereas the EPA test course is a little more advantageous to the hybrid. If you have a longer commute, particularly in stop and go traffic, the Prius would get the mileage that indicated.
I'm told it's a 2-year wait for a Prius. Is that correct?
I think it's not quite that long, but it is 6 months or something.
Well, buy a Honda hybrid instead. You don't have a 2-year wait and get 46 miles to the gallon.
Yeah, the Honda.
That's what we have.
You have one of the Civic hybrids. Yeah, the only problem with the Civic hybrid is it doesn't make that statement. It doesn't look really different. it looks just like the regular Honda, but it gets better gas mileage. Well, of course, for some people, even this isn't big enough. So there's also the stretch option. Okay. Well, enough of that. No, it's just a very poor resolution photo. But this is real, right? It's a limo. It's not for everyday use. Well, okay. Getting back to this issue of sort of thinking about how we consume, you know, here in Holden we have Garbology, and this is people carefully sorting trash, because up here in such a remote environment, you really have to think about everything, where it comes from and where it goes. And in the convenience of our normal lives, we don't have to do that. In Seattle for 15 plus years, we've had curbside recycling, so people have had to make some decisions about which bin to put a waste item in. And the city's been encouraging composting and so on, but you know, Holden obviously takes it to a whole another level. And if you've ever done Garbology, you know you're sorting Q-tips from dental floss and things like that. Very, very detailed waste management. But stepping back, you know, what's happening here is a thinking of the whole material cycle, where it comes from, how it's made, what kind of energy it takes to make it. And then where it goes when it's done. And some of these folks who are in sustainable building are doing precisely this. They're saying, what materials go into this carpet? Are there types of carpet that are less energy intensive or less toxic in their production? Let's buy those instead. Are there carpets that can be recycled? And in fact, there are. And so this is one of the issues that Ron, the architect, is dealing with. It's, you know, which materials produce the less damage. There's a marvelous environmental building at Oberlin College, am I right about that?
Right.
I know what I'm talking about. Where they set out to design this building in a totally innovative way, and it was kind of like this community in Portland that I described. They wanted it to collect all its own water, generate all its own energy, treat all its own wastewater, and even to have the landscape be sustainable and provide food. So they wanted an edible landscape, you know, with berries and so on, so that people would walk around and just nibble to be part of to reconnect with nature. And they spent years researching
building materials, and under the principle that we want to build this building while, as they put it, creating as little ugliness as possible. And they weren't talking about on the building site. They were talking about the forests where the timber was harvested, the manufacturing plants where the pipes were made, and so on and so on. So this whole life cycle concept that plays mainly into building, but also to everything we buy, is starting to catch on. And I think you'll see more and more labels that help consumers conveniently identify those products that are manufactured in a more environmentally friendly manner. Finally, the third thing that we can do besides connect with God and nature and each other and consume more wisely is to speak out. A lot of us have investments, and we haven't even thought about the things that the companies in our portfolios might be doing, but there are environmentally and socially responsible mutual funds that you can invest in. And companies are starting to listen to that. It's also a good investment because companies that are doing some environmental damage on the side are exposing themselves to risks of either toxic spills or lawsuits or other costs. And whereas companies that are more environmentally responsible are, you know, at least reducing that kind of exposure. And as I mentioned, there's a lawsuit about damaging the Earth's climate. Is, you know, it's another kind of exposure that companies are facing. The second is to join environmental organizations where your voice can be joined with a lot of others. One that I would recommend you considering is the Evangelical Environmental Network, which has very much a Christian focus. And they got a lot of press a couple years ago through their campaign, What Would Jesus Drive? Which, you know, a lot of people sort of laughed and said, oh, well, that's silly to, you know, for Christians to say, what would Jesus drive? But, I mean, it was hitting the nail on the head that the single thing Americans can do most easily to improve the environment is to make different choices about what and how far to drive. And the third, and I'm perpetually surprised when I talk to elected officials and they say this over and over again, write to them and say this is important. Not just if you've got, you know, a very, you know, environmentally friendly elected official who, you know, always votes pro-environment. They need the support too. They need to be able to show that they are representing their constituency when they do that, because believe me, they're getting enough letters from the other side saying, you know, don't you dare do this, it's going to be too costly.
I just went to a seminar at the Global Vision event about the e-advocacy with ELCA. Mm. And some of you may be on it, but they were saying that, number one, since 9/11, it often takes 4 to 6 weeks to get a letter. And therefore, if you have a quick thing you want to advocate, it's better to do it via the computer network. But they give you all kinds of information, connect you with your representatives. If you don't know who they are, just put in your zip code and they'll tell you. And I mean, it sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
We have some friends who have done it, but I've never really paid much attention to it, and we're going to. We signed up while we were there. So that's another possibility.
The one thing staffers say about it is that it's a lot easier to ignore an email than a phone call.
That's what we argued with them there, and they said that it's not true anymore. Mm. But that is such a popular thing, it's just as valued. Now, I don't know, we'd always been told that too.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Of course it's better to do it electronically.
The voice of the new generation. And then, you know, this isn't for everybody, but you know, protest. And I was inspired to say this after going to the Bonhoeffer series and just seeing, you know, he really laid it on the line, and a lot of people of faith are being very vocal in that way, and as Laurel and Bruce have showed us, you can protest with a funny mask on, and, you know, make it a fun event and not just kind of an angry event. And stilts, yeah. And finally, I just want to encourage you that if you are interested in moving ahead with some kind of, you know, pro-environment lifestyle or whatever, that you're not alone. That a lot of states and cities and businesses have either made commitments and begun looking at keeping them, or are actually doing that. So Wisconsin has a climate action cost study
that showed that they could make major cuts in emissions while boosting economic growth, which, you know, it's a lot of it has to do with energy efficiency. New Jersey made a commitment several years ago to get their greenhouse gas emissions 3.5% below 1990 levels by 2005. That was under former Governor Christy Todd Whitman, who was Bush's EPA administrator. Oregon in 1997 passed a law that new power plants have to mitigate their CO2 emissions. In other words, pay someone else to either sequester carbon or reduce their carbon emissions.
How are they sequestering that?
Well, the Oregon plan puts things out for competitive bid. And so far, I don't think any of the projects that they've paid for actually involve sequestration. A lot of it was implementing a transportation efficiency plan in some other city, or helping pay for a wind power plant in Nicaragua or something like that. The Northeast governors and Eastern Canadian provinces premiers have a regional greenhouse gas reduction plan, which they're implementing. I didn't add this, but the West Coast governors last September, Washington, Oregon, and California, and since the election, Governor Schwarzenegger has been absolutely on board with this. They are working together to identify ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by those three states. One of the things that's being talked about is having Interstate 5 become a hydrogen corridor, so that you could buy a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle and know that you can travel up and down I-5, which actually a huge amount of commerce and tourists do. Another thing they're talking about is the stringent fuel economy requirements that California is attempting to implement. If Oregon and Washington got on board with those, it would be much easier for California to go ahead with that. They've been really innovative about a lot of these emissions, air pollution problems. Finally, Cities for Climate Protection. 11 states, the attorney generals are pressing Bush to act, and then, as I said, there's a lawsuit against fossil fuel industries. And then finally, Cities for Climate Protection is an organization that many big cities belong to. Miami is very concerned about sea level rise, so they'd like to see this problem solved. That's all I had prepared. I would very much like to open it up to discussion. Yes?
Several things. I guess I've got a 1977 Ford pickup. It gets 28 miles per gallon. Now a 2004 Ford pickup gets 16 miles per gallon.
Yeah. Yeah, the fuel economy has actually gotten worse in the last 20 years. It improved after the corporate average fuel economy, or CAFE standards, were passed in the 1970s as a result of the oil shocks in 1973. Pickups and so-called light trucks, which includes SUVs, are not included in the CAFE standards. And back at the time, 85% of vehicle sales were passenger vehicles. But now, only less than 50% are passenger vehicles because of the growth in popularity of SUVs, which don't have to meet those standards. So one of the things that has come up repeatedly in Congress is to improve the CAFE standards. And it's always shot down by the auto industry. And this is one of those things where a little piece of legislation would go a really long way.
Another thing was this. 25 years ago, a man showed the seminar on how, by preheating the fuel, he was able to get an old Ford Fairlane, 65 Ford Fairlane, he got 100 miles per gallon by heating the fuel before it went into the carburetor. And then he went on to talk more about how the Ford Motor Company bought up his patent and they put it away. And then Mitsubishi also had a ceramic engine that got 200 miles per gallon. And that was supposed to have been out on the market by now. And Ford Motor Company also had a prototype. And those ceramic engines now are not on the market. They were supposed to have been out in 2000, getting 200 miles per gallon. And the point is that these auto companies are buying up these patents and putting them away. The Bush administration is allowing that
I've heard such allegations before, and under the Clinton administration, there was the Partnership for a New Generation of Vehicles, which was the goal of which was to build a production. Go ahead and just shut off the projector there. The goal was to build a vehicle that got 75 miles a gallon. It was a joint effort of the Department of Transportation and the auto industry. And they weren't able to do it in several years of effort. And I think you would find that this 200 mile per gallon vehicle is violates the law of physics. That's actually it would require more energy than it exists.
It's just a matter of heating the fuel up.
But if you look at the amount of energy in a gallon of gas, if you were able to burn it with perfect efficiency using, there have been similar statements about magnets, and if you put magnets in certain places in your engine and so on. And I'm certainly ready to believe that gas. You're ready now. Where's
my
hair? I'm certainly ready to believe that automotive companies would do that. I also think that given that they're now seeing that there's a market for really fuel efficient vehicles, that they would produce a really fuel efficient vehicle if they could. And Ford is going to come out in a month or two with its 2005 hybrid Escape. GM has a whole bunch of hybrid vehicles in the works.
But those are mild hybrids that are maybe 10%
more. Right, and the fuel efficiency here, and they're trying to cater to a market where fuel efficiency is important. And they're not getting 50, 60, 80 miles to the gallon. They're getting 25 instead of 20, with these vehicles. So. I have to wonder whether this sounds a little bit like sort of a snake oil salesman kind of thing. I've got this magic product I'll sell you for $75 and it'll improve your efficiency by 100%. That may have been true in some cases, but there are a lot of such stories, and I haven't actually seen. We better move on. There was a question back here, and then up in the balcony. So, yes, ma'am.
In the latest Christian Century, where they have just a miscellaneous collection of facts, they reported that if all the pavements in the United States, 48 states, were put together, it would equal an area the size of Ohio. It was quite a shocking statistic. The second thing I just wanted to add to your speaking out, if we can speak out in our congregations, I think that's an area where recycling and using the land around the buildings and being more energy efficient in our buildings, even if it would cost more initially when we make choices. Speaking up for the environment and not just for the lowest item on the budget.
Yep, good point.
And then,
yes,
and okay, last night if someone
somebody before you, do you have a question?
It was like they get the pressure less powerful and it was smaller, lighter, more flimsy, more dangerous being on the roads.
Yeah, there
by efficiency vehicles.
There is that concern, and Trent Lott famously showed a photo of some very tiny high gas mileage vehicle in Senate debates on CAFE standards a couple years ago, and said I do not want to force Americans to drive these. And in fact, safety is a big part of what drives people's vehicle choices. And they remember their high school physics that in a collision, the object with the most mass experiences the least acceleration. And so they say, well, I want the most massive vehicle, which is generally an SUV. And they also like being up high, so they choose an SUV for that reason as well. So people end up thinking they're safer in an SUV, but in fact, they would be safer in a sedan that handled well. Because SUVs are much more inclined to roll over, even if it's not a Ford Explorer with Bridgestone tires, and they're also much worse at accident avoidance, so they're more likely to be involved in an accident. And so even though a flimsy sedan may feel less safe, in fact, if you look at the statistics, they are actually comparable to an SUV, unless you've got a really, really well-designed kind of broad footprint, low center of gravity SUV like the Mercedes. So it's sort of a false perception. And also, let's face it, driving is risky. And the best way to reduce your chances of being killed in an auto accident are to reduce the number of miles you drive. So, that safety issue, I really appreciate you raising that, because it's an important point that, it very much drives people's vehicle choices. And unfortunately, people don't have all the information about what would really be the safest choice. Yes, and then you again.
I think one thing is to start right at home, in our churches, in our homes. And we just saw a video on affluenza, which many of you have seen probably. Mm-hmm. There's books, there's a book here in a whole village on affluenza. We have to realize that it's going to cost us more, in many cases, to get things that are less environmentally dangerous or harmful. And one small thing. I mean, we were talking about having throwaway disposable communion cups, because nobody wants to take the time anymore to wash them. Mm-hmm. To me, that is a terrible thing. Now, you can argue other ways, because then you won't be using the soap, et cetera, et cetera. It's hard sometimes. But I think just speaking out and speaking about things is the way we have to go. And it's not always popular, even within your church.
Yeah. And the way our church has approached it has been very positive. It's just, let's do some fun events. And what we've heard back from people is, we like having these things going on, even if we don't necessarily go to the transportation fair or participate in the monthly bike, walk, carpool to church Sunday. They like the fact that the church is doing that, and that it makes them think about it. Yes?
Last night there was a program, so you might have seen it after Vesper's, about Bush and religion, and how two-thirds of America's church-going people voted for George Bush. And George Bush has created the disaster in Iraq. I wonder if anybody's contemplated the environmental impact of the war in Iraq, or being associated with fossil fuels. He obviously enjoys a huge, massive overuse of fossil fuels, where Al Gore was, if had been president, would probably have this country well underway to hydrogen power. He was very interested in alternative fuels. And the point I'm going to make is, if we're church-going people, but yet church-going people elected George Bush in the last election, we've got to rethink a lot of things. We've got to celebrate creation, and we can't re-elect George Bush. It's a fossil fuel environmental disaster. The PT Cruiser, this little tiny car, is considered a truck because those are things that the Bush administration has pushed off all these regulations on auto industries for 10 more years, where they would have been in place by now, but George Bush has said, well, we'll give you 10 more years to meet these fuel efficiency considerations. And it's really, the Bush administration is ruining our environment.
One of the lessons that came out of the acid rain and ozone depletion issues, and I don't remember which issue this was, but the industry group in question said, it was sort of an on the side, not a public statement. We can meet any target. Just give us a target to meet. And that's true of the auto industry too. If Congress tomorrow passed CAFE standards and said by 2012 all vehicles have, the average vehicle sold in America has to get 40 miles to the gallon.
Yeah, what's the auto industry can do it. And now Bush pushed it off for 10 more years to 2015. Yeah. He pushed it off.
Phil? Let's see. 1, 2, 3.
I just wanted to comment. I appreciated your comment about making choices in where you invest. But I think another place you can make choices is in organizations that you belong to. And one of those that's kind of one of my pet peeves is AAA, because they provide a good service that people appreciate, and yet they're one of the strongest lobbies against mass transit and spending any dollars on pedestrian or bike facilities.
That's just inexcusable. I don't know why they do that. There is an organization, and thank you for raising that. There is
an alternative to AAA that provides all of the services minus the lobby for comparable cost. So look into that and see if that's.
You know what that is?
I'm sorry, I don't remember what it is or where it's based. Let's see. Yes, ma'am, and then.
I was going to say, in 1988, I was in Norway, I remember that there they do the opposite. Here, if we use more of something, we get a better price. And there, they were metered with all their energy on their washers and dryers and refrigerator and everything, and they stayed under a certain limit. They had a cheaper rate of pay, and then if they went over that, they were paying at a much higher rate. And I think Americans need more incentives like that. To kind of encourage and get some of this going the other way.
Yeah, one problem with the way a lot of American utilities work, and in Seattle we do have that increasing price the more you use for residential use. The problem is that we get our bill for a 2-month period, and it arrives 2 weeks after the end of that 2-month period. So, you have to be. It has to be built into your appliance decisions and things like that. It can't be, oh, gee, I realize I, used a lot of electricity today. I better go easy tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like people were much
meters,
more aware right in the home
of what
they were using.
They have meters that they could just look
at
and keep track of. Yeah. Those very simple, small things on the wall that they were keeping exact assurance right there on their feature.
Yeah. One thing that utilities should be required, and many of them are now required to do, is what's called net metering. Some people are installing solar panels or even wind turbines at their homes, and if they generate more electricity than they use during a given minute, they'll actually run their meter backwards. So they're pumping electricity back into the grid. But that requires a law to force utilities to do that. And obviously, it's a good incentive for you if you've got, just imagine if you had a farm out in Nebraska and the whole time you were here, you had a bunch of wind turbines that were pumping electricity back into the grid and you were making money. Wouldn't that feel good?
Travel the year round.
Yeah.
Dave. I just want to respond to that. Give us a goal, we can meet it. Yesterday, you were talking about endangered species and the Klamath Falls area, waters and farmers. We have a similar area or similar issue where I'm from. It's when you bring everybody to the table, then you can set a goal and meet it. Our situation started with a debacle like you can't have any water, period, because of endangered species, which is an understandable concern. And once we got over that threat, posturing, concern, articulation, and get people saying, it's amazing how fast you can adapt if you're all pulling on the same team. Mm-hmm. So to ask irrigators in my valley not to use as much water, you can't do that this summer. But if you give us 4 or 5, and if we get a system where we all agree upon, there's still pain, there's still loss, there's still loss of jobs, but you begin to get something that is workable. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't know how it works in the auto industry, for example,
Well, that was one of the things that this book I read about the ozone issue, that he concluded that one of the reasons it was so successful was they actually brought the CFC producers to the table and said, let's talk about just what it would take to introduce replacements. And bludgeoning the auto industry with some regulations is, it may be effective, but it may be more effective to talk about what are realistic targets for CAFE standards, recognizing that there are going to be costs to the industry of increasing fuel efficiency.
I think it's another place where we as a church or an individual Christian in our various jobs can be effective.
Yeah.
Is by recognizing that these people aren't necessarily our enemy, but we do have common concern and try to use our perspective on that to bring people around the table, because I think we can do that as a church.
Next church did. Okay, one, and then two, and then three, and then four.
One statistic relating to petroleum. The total United States reserves of petroleum, our total known petroleum, is 23 billion barrels. Now that doesn't mean much unless we know how much we use per year. 7.1. Our total U.S. petroleum reserves are a little over 3 years, between 3 and 4 years. So we are importing 60%. That's why we're in Iraq. That's why we're interested in the Middle East, and that's why we have to really cut down on petroleum usage. And going up to Alaska and the game refuge up there, 1 or 2% of our petroleum would ever come from there, if we're lucky.
6 months.
And it'd take a long time, and so on. So that's a...
Yeah, when Bush said we need to reduce our imports of foreign oils.
That's right.
That's right. And the only way we're going to do it is by improving fuel
economy. Conservation.
Yeah, because we can't do it by drilling in every coastal zone and landmark and everything. Okay.
These hybrid cars are kind of a waste of time. They're stalling the technology that we need to do, and they're satisfying people thinking, oh, we're getting better gas mileage. But in fact, it's just fooling us all to think that that's helping, because it's wasting time. We don't have 5 years to waste trying to creep up to a fuel efficiency that we already had back in the 70s. I'm telling you, those cars used to get so much better gas mileage than they do now. And they're purposefully getting worse gas mileage now, because the Bush administration is just allowing the car companies to just put it off, put it off, put it off. And it's wrong.
The Bush administration has also committed major money to developing hydrogen
The research
fuel cell,
has already been done, and he's saying, oh, we need to spend money on research. That's all he's spending, $1 billion on research. But the research has already been done. We already know how to make hydrogen-powered cars. And so he's telling the country...
Yeah, it's not the manufacture of the vehicles, it's the infrastructure that would require huge investment.
But
on a related issue, a recent issue of Scientific American, I don't remember where I said this, analyzed the total fuel use of different kinds of vehicles and concluded that actually hydrogen fuel cell vehicles are not any better than a hybrid vehicle, because it's so costly, or even given 10 years of investments in some kind of distribution system, it would still be so costly to compress and transport the hydrogen that the total energy use would be similar.
The transportation of hydrogen fuel can be done through the natural gas pipelines. It can be delivered to houses through the existing pipelines, and it could be produced by wind and hydrogen power, hydro power, and wind power. Could produce the hydrogen power that we need could be done by renewable energies.
I've read that to get all our energy from wind and solar, we'd have to have an area roughly the size of Nebraska covered with solar energy.
It would
any Nebraskans here? Should we?
Just for each bomb we dropped in Iraq, we could have built a turbine.
Yeah,
we could have had
Another really simple way I think that we can reduce waste in this country, and this is actually really relevant to my husband and I right now, is by using cloth diapers and encouraging our families and church members to do that. I heard a statistic that if one child wears diapers for 3 years, disposable diapers, they accumulate 6,000 diapers total that are not biodegradable. And another statistic I heard is that right now, and I don't know in the last 20 years, but in the last 15 or so years, disposable diapers are taking up more room in landfills than fast food waste.
Mark, and that's going to be the last comment.
I just want to recommend a book by Paul Simon. Maybe you've seen it, 52 Ways to Make a Difference. And Paul Simon was here last September for a theological conference, and then his last public speech was at Pacific Lutheran University before he died. But one thing Simon said, and it stuck with me, when you're talking about writing letters, he made the statement, and he said, whenever you write a letter about an issue of this kind that's a concern to you, you're likely saving a life. And so he really encouraged people not to underestimate the power of writing letters to people. And it kind of woke me up, because I'd written a few along the way, but I thought, does it really make all that much difference? And he said, do it. And the other thing he said is only once in his whole career as a politician, he said, did everybody just line up and things fall into place on a given decision? He says, these things need to be hammered out. And I think I picked that up from you, as even as you're giving us solutions, you're recognizing that this is not an easy process, but we still need to do it.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.